Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. And I think my experience with people who get very insulted in it and exasperated about VAs and stuff is that they are unclear. And I've been this person. I probably still am in something.
We all have.
Yeah. I mean, examples of where I outsource that has worked well. My podcast editor, for example, examples of where it's not worked so well. I've got a bookkeeper who's really intelligent guy, probably too intelligent, Indian guy who tend to be quite precise. And that's another cultural differences thing to negotiate, right? The podcast is American. So he's used to me kind of throwing stuff at him, and he just kind of makes it work and doesn't get upset about being imperfect, whereas the Filipinos famously are perfectionist, and it's all that stuff. But I mean, I would say in most cases where it hasn't worked, I've just threw a load of bookkeeping at him and said, do my bookkeeping, as opposed to thinking through for myself in articulating what do I really need from this process. And then above all, not articulating to him, I don't need the most complete tax accounts in the world. It's not going to be examined by Deloitte or somebody next week. What I need is management accounting that will give me profitability by product line. And it wouldn't have taken me long to articulate that to him. And I didn't. I just said, do it. And of course, he's now spent hours on my books. Yeah. And I'm thinking, do I need to fire this guy? I'm not getting the result I want. And of course, I didn't explain the result up front. So that's a classic example of how not to do it from my experience.
On that, I think you made a great point, Michael. So what usually happens when we hire people is we are, you know, the micromanager. We are giving them a task. We're, you know, and then they're coming back to us. We're spoon feeding them tasks, which, you know, we're, once they've done that, then we give them another task. You know, that's going to be the most, that's why people really struggle with hiring people and team, is because of that reason. So what's going to be absolutely critical, if you give them absolutely clear outcomes, specific results that you want, and, you know, let them figure some of it out themselves, you know. So it depends on the role that you hire for, of course. But, you know, let's say that you are, instead of giving them everything, and, you know, if you think about the amount of work, they're supposed to be taken off your plate, not adding more to your plate. So the whole point of hiring a team is so they can remove, you know, stress and tasks and areas of the business from your plate and own them and be responsible for them, and giving them clear outcomes of what you're looking for, and then kind of coaching them, you know, on what they've done. And that is how you basically scale a team. If you're going to be doing that spoon feeding task forever, then no wonder people, you know, this is what I see a lot. No wonder people don't want to hire, because it's like, oh, I've got, you know, another task to do, is tell them what to do now. And they keep coming to me instead of giving them clear results that they're going to be responsible for. And then just, you know, coaching them and mentoring them along the way is, you know, one of the biggest things, which is it changes the game for people. And, you know, that comes from like Vern Harnish's book, Scaling Up. You know, coaching and mentoring any of your team members on the outcomes that you're looking for is going to be the most powerful things for them, because they feel cared for, they feel respected, they feel important, which they are. And you're also showing them how to grow as a person as well. You're not just spoon feeding tasks. You know, I don't know about you, but I would hate to be told every task what to do, how to do it. And, you know, I want to be able to be responsible for some part, which is moving the company forward towards the predefined goals that you set for the year, for the quarter, for the month. And as a team member that's having a part in helping your team achieve these goals and outcomes, there's nothing more exciting. And, you know, you really become a team then. If you are just micromanaging them and giving them tasks without clear outcomes, then they're going to become annoyed and it's going to be exhausting for you.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And I think, because I've experienced both again. I mean, like with
don't worry.
the bookkeeping guy, for example, Mudit, he has a name, and a good guy. I mean, he's got a background. He worked for Deloitte in India. So I'm obviously quite a high-powered guy, and I think he'd weigh probably too high-powered for me. So I probably should have said, look, this is going to be shockingly primitive. It's a culture thing, I guess, like Indian, very precise somehow. I don't know why. They're very mathematically oriented, and that's what good programmers and good accountants, I guess. I don't traditionally seem to be good at those skills. I'm not saying that's all they do. We're talking about 1.1 billion people. But, you know, traditionally, they're very good at those skill sets, particularly. And I can see why. But again, that's almost like a culture clash between that Indian thing, the kind of Western entrepreneur, the online entrepreneur versus the corporate culture. There's a few cultural differences I can see there. And I can see now in retrospect, I should have sat down and said, look, it's a small business. The sort of thing that you would find shockingly, ridiculously amateurish is probably exactly what I want. The sort of thing you would think of as professional is what I would think is ridiculously over the top and not necessary. So let's clarify that. And I should have said, the reverse engineering, I need to get hold of this guy and talk to him, but and said, here is the outcomes that I want, and here's what doesn't interest me out of the traditional bookkeeping things. And the thing is also, I can't just say, it's not like customer service I've done to death. I can't just say, do this, then do this. I can't even micromanage him because I'm not competent enough in bookkeeping to do that. I mean, it can get complex quickly. What I need to do is set clear outcomes and then ask him, okay, so from the bookkeeping specialist perspective, what do you think we need to do? He's been kind of micromanaging me because I gave him like such a generalized thing. He's been going, okay, I need this account and I need this. And by the way, I want your mortgage statement now. And I'm like, why do you need this? So I don't understand why he wants stuff from me. He doesn't understand what I want from him. It's just, it's not pretty. And I have to say in my defense that with the podcast, for example, we've got a little team chat and my podcast editor knows that he's part of something that is trying to achieve an outcome of launching a course and trying to reach a new audience. And my webmaster is also part of that. So there is a team culture. And funnily enough, it works much better. So I can endorse what you're saying.
Yes, it totally does. And on that point, which you just made, having a clear mission, purpose around what you stand for, you know, is the basis of your company culture, right? Where you're going together. That's strategic planning at its best. What's the BHAG? Where are we going? You know, what's our outcome? Who do we want to really help and serve? And that's the long term. Then you've got the year ahead, the quarter ahead, the month ahead. What do we do this week? And you know, that is missing from the majority of businesses out there. And the reason the biggest companies in the world are the biggest companies in the world because they have that process locked down in place, it's a clear correlation. The only difference between a big company and a small company is process and systems. That's literally the difference. That's what it is. So
that's quite a statement. That's a very tweetable. The only difference between a big company and a small company is the culture and the processes that have in place. I mean, I guess you could argue they have a lot more money and stuff, but then on the other hand, they got to that place because they had a vision. So
they got to that place because they had a clear direction, in terms of where they're going, for the year ahead. Like Apple and these companies like Microsoft, they plan like 5 years ahead, like 4 or 5 years ahead. You know, if we just plan a year ahead, we're going to be miles ahead of most people. But why it's relevant to this conversation is because when you're bringing on new team members, you need to hire people that really believe in what you're doing and want to get behind that and be part of this team. Because if you hire somebody that's not really interested, is going to do a half-assed job, then you're going to always have problems there. And they're not going to fit the culture.
And I think my experience with people who get very insulted in it and exasperated about VAs and stuff is that they are unclear. I've been this person. I probably still am in something.
We all have.
Yeah, I mean,
I think it should be about.
Yeah. And I remember going to some management thing years ago. I mean, I was working for a local music service, which was pretty uninspiring, but they were inspiring enough people. I found the job itself extremely boring and I left, but which is right, because I wasn't a fit for their culture. They brought some management consultants in, of all things, which is pretty unusual for a local music service, like teaching beginner trumpet, whatever, which is what I was doing at the time. And actually, they brought some people in and said, look, when you've got a team, you've got to think about each member of the team has their own personal goals you've got to appeal to, which is the what it's in it for me thing. But they also need to buy into the team goals And then there was something else. I forget the third component, which may be critical. But the point is that whilst it's no good saying we are, you know, an amazing company and I'm obsessed with myself, and they go, yeah, well, why should I do this? You've got to answer that question. But I think that the next level of mistake is to not really do anything except say, yeah, I'm going to pay you lots of money and that should be enough. Is that people want to be part of something bigger than themselves. And actually, it's easy to overlook that, to be cynical and go, these guys just want $5 an hour. You know, they don't. And my experience is, you know, recognition. I'm personally in the same. If I'm doing something for somebody, a bit of recognition just really counts. Like if somebody's paying me, you know, hundreds of pounds to go to a mastermind with me or mentoring or something, it still matters to me. Say, like, Mike, thanks. That was a great day. That really helped me. It still feeds me because that's part of my mission. That's part of why I do stuff. It's never just about the money, whether it's tiny money or big money. And it's easy to forget that, I think, because we get so numerically driven as Amazon sellers, because it's all online. We forget that you've got to inspire people.
You can always have that challenge of, you know, if there's no real buy-in from them, you know, to make money is not inspiring for people. They can help a company make money anywhere in the world. If they can be a part of something which is bigger than themselves, giving them recognition and appreciation they deserve, which are helping you move towards your predefined outcomes, and being part of that team is something I think everybody wants to be part of.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, we've got a million things we could ask about this. I've just got a couple more questions, and I'd love to ask a bit more about what you do at Systems Culture Impact, because obviously, unsurprisingly, you specialize in this stuff. You've obviously got really clear, insightful processes in place, very impressive. So one couple of quick questions then about the things that keep coming up. Again, with some quite serious people, this isn't just a newbie kind of question with outsourcing, or indeed the question of outsourcing versus in-house hiring. What are your thoughts on that conundrum?
Right. So it depends on, you know, where you kind of base. I think a lot of the time in your particular situation, we talked about it a bit earlier on in the podcast. If you're getting started, hire out a process, contractors are fine. You know, they can be anywhere in the world. I think it completely depends on your situation, but start off with processes, getting things, you know, particular areas of the business, and then bring somebody in part-time, whether that's local to you, it's up to you. It depends on the profit you have in your business that you can afford to pay somebody local. If you're based in UK, USA, and so forth, then you need to look at that in regards to, do I want to have somebody local to me that can work virtual? We can connect every week if we want to, because it's just down the road, or have them completely virtual. So I think it depends on where you are in the state in your business. You can hire amazing people virtually. People are growing virtual teams, you know, everywhere and doing it really, really well. It depends on, so when you say in-house, I presume that you mean having an office and having people go there. Is that what
I guess
you mean?
No, that wasn't. You know what? That was what I meant, and I actually articulated it really poorly. I mean, I suppose what we're talking about is a personal in-person assistant versus a virtual assistant. So you've answered that question very well. Actually, work in both cases, but yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's always struck me, and Tim Ferriss said this, and he famously talks about outsourcing a lot. Whether he's personally that great at it or not, I mean, people obsess about Tim Ferriss. I don't care. I think the ideas were valid, whether or not he did them all. It doesn't really matter. It's an interesting debate that gets the answers, just to lance that boil. But yeah, he was talking about the whole thing of, like, people obsess about cost per hour, and he says the right metric is cost per completed task. And to give an example, coming back to bookkeeping, it might be that this Indian dude who's incredibly well qualified and clever, it seems to me, and is working me for between $10 and $16 an hour, depending which skill set he's using, like the whole accounting versus bookkeeping, versus my British-based accountant who I've worked with for a while, who's £90 an hour, so whatever that, $110, whatever it is. It may be I'll end up going back to her because I can clarify stuff to and articulate to her. She understands me. She understands perhaps British entrepreneurial culture and how we work and all the compromises we're willing to have. Perhaps that might be the better spend of money and actually overall cheaper to end up with a set of accounts that are usable management accounts for me. So I always think that's a really important thing to bear in mind. If you've got any other thoughts on that, as somebody who does deal with virtual teams.
Right. So I think the question is working out whether you have somebody like a contractor, like in your case, a bookkeeper that you can go and visit and see and connect with, right?
Yes.
Versus virtual.
Virtual, yeah.
So in that situation, I think that can be completely done virtual. But I think there needs to be, you know, for things like bookkeeping and accounts, having, you know, for us at least, having that with a company that can scale with us is really, really important, because we don't want to particularly have to grow, you know, a big accounting department in our company, because right now you can get all that stuff taken care of off your plate and someone else manage it, like overseas. If the guy's from India, you know, if he's working in a company, then usually that's scalable for you. So if you're just working with one guy and your business trebled, he's going to really struggle to understand and keep up with that. If your business trebled, but you've got a team of accountants that are experienced in that and can do that overseas and deliver, all you need is delivery of the specific reports you need to see, and the numbers need to be accurate on time every month, right? It's a very straightforward kind of, you know, this black and white, right?
It's
not like there's no in between. It's like they need to be 100% right, and they need to be on time every time. So with that in mind, if that's happening and you can connect with him on a call, but you know, on Zoom once a month, then that is all you need, you know, to go and sit down with him and go through stuff, I don't think is necessary. The numbers speak everything. The outcome speaks everything. And a call on Zoom face to face is just as good as sat there with him.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I think the issue is not your finger on it. The question is not whether it's virtual or physically there. It's more a question of culture, isn't it? Because I've got a business coach who is in Seattle, Washington. It's 8 hours, eight time zones away. I mean, I've never flown there, and it's way too far. That's not the problem, because he's American internet marketer and I'm British internet marketer. There's enough cultural similarity that actually we speak kind of the same language, whereas my wife doesn't understand half the things I say these days, because, you know, we understand music kind of speak, which is a speak in itself, which I have no idea what I'm talking about. I mean, she's getting there. She's a bright lady and picked it up. But my mates in London, if I ever mention like affiliate marketing or internet marketing or conversion rate, they kind of look at me like, I'm sorry, I didn't quite get that. So from that point of view, maybe it comes down to a cultural match more than geography, which I think you've just put your finger on something, a very important distinction that I think people model together. It doesn't really matter whether the person sitting next to you in the desk or not. The fact is they need to understand you and you need to understand them. And that, I think
it's just
a broader cultural question.
I think it's just, what is the specific outcome that I'm here to get?
Yes.
Culture or not, if there's a specific clear outcome that you're looking for, like if they're from India or whatever, this is a specific outcome that we want. You know, this is what we need to see each and every month. And then we jump on a monthly call to talk about, you know, anything that, you know, a strategic call for them, giving you what they see in the numbers. You know, if you've got any questions for them, then you can do that on that call. But I just think having a very clear outcome, you know, and having that very, very clearly explained and kind of delivered to them so they understand exactly what you want and there's no in between then.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for my therapizing my relationship with my bookkeeper. I mean, it's funny because in theory, I know this because like a lot of things, the irony is, and I'm just relating this, that the blood and guts and the kind of my mess up with this so that people can relate to it and get over their shame.
Oh, totally. Because, no, we all do it. You know,
yeah, I mean, sure. Totally. But the thing, what I did is I'm like, I just the impatience, like I want this off my desk. I just want management consults. I just, you know, to the point where I was so impatient and quick, and this is such an entrepreneurial thing that, we go, just do it. And the thing is, do what? You haven't clarified what it is. You haven't even clarified the scope of what it is, you know, and you haven't clarified the outcomes. And you haven't clarified like the bigger picture outcomes, not just the deliverables, but why in the bigger context of the picture, sorry, big context of your business, you want them at all. Okay, I need management accounts, not tax accounts. I need to know profit loss by product. Why is this? So that I can make decisions to develop products or kill them off. And you know what? So I need to go and have that conversation. So thank you for your time on that. Last question then is really a really important one as well. What do you do with the time you gain? Let's say that I stop spending hours banging my head against spreadsheets for 10 hours a week trying to make sense of my numbers, and I gain 10 hours a week, and maybe I spend an hour a week once things are set up managing this person, so I've gained 9 hours net, if you like. What is the most productive thing to do with that time? You've already talked about product creation, which is obviously critical for any e-commerce seller. Anything else that has come across your desk with your client base that they do that's different, that's productive for them?
Yeah, absolutely. So for the most part, you know, people come to us, they're doing 10 to 30 hours, sometimes even more a week on operational tasks. So one of the challenges is, okay, once we take this off your plate, the customer service, bookkeeping, inventory management, what are you going to spend it on? You can't, you know, it's not going to work. You know, I tell this to people, you know, we don't want to work with you if you're just going to go on holiday, because you're not going to see the return. Now, you need to obviously allocate that time to profit generation, whether that's creating new products and launching them, you know, you're not having to do it all yourself, but the ideation of the products and whether it's opening up new marketplaces, a lot of people are itching to get to Europe if they're in the USA, or the USA if they're in Europe, because they know their opportunity is huge there, but they've already got the product lines, they've got everything in place, they just need to get it over there to capitalize on that. But you know, that in some cases could be, you know, an extra, you know, 50 grand a month for a lot of sellers. If they've got a successful established brand, the work, you know, is minimal in getting over there compared to what you'd have to do if you, you know, started fresh, for instance. So they're two clear, very, you know, common ones, but more so is building your brand, building your audience, removing, you know, getting off of Amazon and not having all your eggs in that basket of being, just, you know, an Amazon seller where your focus is on, you know, capturing the low hanging fruit on Amazon, for instance, building an asset like an email list, a database, you know, or messenger bot subscribers, where you can basically make offers to a group of people that love your products, love what you're doing, and can help you make more money on Amazon and help you make more money off of Amazon, sending them to your Shopify store or where, you know, whatever the store you have.
Absolutely. I mean, this absolutely makes sense, because you're basically, yeah, these are whole new chunks to your business, or whole new expansion possibilities rather than just the day-to-day. And it just struck me while we were talking that one of the reasons, and it's kind of obvious, but one of the reasons we don't expand into new things is we get into a comfort zone. We get good at what we're doing. And I guess the whole point of expanding a business and being an entrepreneur is, if you're too good at what you're doing, it's probably because you've been doing the same thing for a while, which means you're not expanding your business, which means as an entrepreneur, as distinct from a businessman, you know, business person, if you're running a corporate entity and you're CEO, maybe your business is going really well, doing the same damn thing for 10 years. But if you're an entrepreneur, you're not doing the job if you're not outside your comfort zone, I guess. So it just struck me, no wonder we keep doing the same darn things. It's a lot more comfortable than going, right, now I'm going to go to Germany and I don't speak the language and I don't know how it's done and I don't know how to deal with VAT. And, you know, that's probably a sign of growing pains, right?
Yeah. Well, it's like, you know, if you're only selling on Amazon, there's like hundreds of thousands of sellers, millions of sellers, all competing for the low-hanging fruit. You know, that's when you launch a product, you know, a good way to get going. But, you know, as soon as possible, in most cases, I would even, if you're starting out now, I would be more focused on how can I build an audience before I launch, because it's a whole different game. If you're trying to capture the low hanging fruit on Amazon with tens of thousands of sellers, everybody's sending the same product from the same supplier, you know, and following the same system, you're going to get the same results. So how can you figure out how to build an audience around a brand, a product line that sells and makes a meaningful difference in people's lives? You can use that audience to then launch on Amazon, you know, you launch your products to Shopify. And that is an asset which is going to be critical if you're looking to sell your business down the line. You know, it's going to be a huge factor in determining the multiple that you'll get, you know, which obviously creates a high risk for any investor or buyer if they don't have, you know, if Amazon's the only source of, you know, revenue stream, then that's, you know, going to lower the money that you can receive from all that hard work you've poured into it. So having the right systems in place with instructions on how to do all the tasks are going to reduce risk for a buyer. Having assets away from Amazon that you can use to drive offers to that audience are going to also present lower risk for a buyer.
Absolutely. Yeah. And funnily enough, we had the guys from Providium, which is a Wall Street-based firm who are bringing private equity investors as buyers of Amazon businesses. So we talked extensively about that. And it's funny how at the higher level, it's about connecting up the dots, right? It's putting together the outsourcing piece with the, you know, the customer service piece with the, you know, the outsourcing and the culture of outsourcing and having systems and processes. It all gradually adds up together to sort of two sides of the same coin, really. So yeah, I think preparing your business to sell is the ultimate in, now I'm going to have to get everything else sorted. But as we said, preparing to outsource your business, as we've just been discussing, or going through the process of outsourcing things, forces you to do, I think, just as valuable work on company culture, which I think mm-hmm. you've articulated beautifully. So, you know, what's really nice, Aaron, about what your message and everything about you, and clearly comes through so clearly in our conversation, is that the culture thing and the big picture and then linking that to the individual people and individual tasks is really critical. And I love that, because it's quite different from the, you know, the traditional approach to outsourcing, which is very mechanical. And I think that may be why people are struggling. So tell us a bit more about what you guys offer. Obviously, you're very, very experienced in a lot of this stuff. It shines through what you're saying. What do you guys offer for people at systemscultureimpact.com who want to not just do this stuff on their own?
Yeah, thanks for having me on today. Really enjoyed it, and hopefully it's been helpful for some people. So what we do really for high six and seven figure sellers is we just come into their business and methodically remove inventory management, customer service, bookkeeping off their plates with our pre-trained, FBA trained team. We already have all the systems and the processes, like standard operating procedures, which are basically written documentation on how to do all of that stuff. We just hand them kind of a filing cabinet for them and personalize it to their business. So we would remove inventory management off their plate, personalize all of our SOPs for their business, and run it for them for 3 months to 12 months, depending on the client and how we want to get started. But that's really what we do. We remove things from the plate, get them organized with all of our SOPs to help them remove that glass ceiling so they can keep scaling their business. It's kind of like plugging in an operations department to businesses. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally makes sense. I mean, and it sounds really good. And I guess that, plug in an operations department in so you can focus on growing the business. Sounds kind of pretentious or kind of silly, but in the first instance, if you're used to doing the work, and there's a certain mentality amongst entrepreneurs that can happen with solopreneurs that, it's a bit like the small shopkeeper mentality. He works 70-hour weeks and has profit. And that's great. It's working, but it's not sustainable and it's not expandable. And I guess we have to be courageous enough to go, now I need to get myself out of that and focus, as we said, on, just a small bit of maths on the value of a new product line versus the value of bookkeeping or customer service. Just is extremely compelling. So yeah, absolutely makes sense to plug you guys in and then move on to bigger picture things.
What people find helpful, just to make it more clear, what people find most helpful is they don't have to go and find the staff, train them, hire them, onboard them, create the SOPs in the hopes that they got it right, in the hopes that they found the right person. We just bring all that. We have backup VAs, if it's not working out at all times. And we basically just take care of that whole thing and solve all the issues around their system that they've got in their current specific situation. So,
right.
That's pretty much it. If that resonates at all, if you want to, have a chat, all you need to do is reach out, and you can go to systemscultureimpact.com/go, and there'll be a short survey, and we'll jump on a quick call and see kind of where you're at, where you need. If we can't help, then I'll be more than happy to point you in the right direction.
Excellent. And I believe they've also got some free training on how to create a product launch machine, if I understand that's right. So we're going to do a forward from amazingfba.com/blueprint. So what's included in that, just briefly, if anyone's interested in that?
Yeah. So in light of our conversation today of, setting up systems, one of the biggest ones for Amazon people, e-commerce sellers, is they are not wanting to do all of the tasks involved with launching a new product. So we want to be able to set up a well-oiled product launch machine. So yes, we can focus on creating the products, but we have a team in place to help execute on that launch process. So you can come up with the ideas, you can approve and oversee and coach along the way, but you're not having to do all of the steps in between. So it's basically like a PDF. You can use it if you want it. A ton of people got load of value from it, and it'll show you how to set up that system for yourself. So it's at amazingfba.com/blueprint.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, we'll get that set up as soon as the podcast is live. So excellent. Thank you, Aaron. It's been excellent stuff. I mean, really, it's a bit of therapy for me on an example of me messing up the outsourcing thing. But I just think that was just an example of where I know damn well from doing it well that it does work if you articulate the value of your team, to your team rather, of where you want to go, what's important to you, what is important to not do, what the outcomes are, having done that sometimes and sometimes failed to, the difference is really extremely big. So I think what you've articulated today is really important for people to hear and to go away and reflect on. And if nothing else, to track your time, as you say, again, it's a tough discipline, but it's so, so revealing, so incredibly rewarding.
Absolutely.
So fantastic message and clear, actionable stuff as well. So really valuable and great to have you on. Thank you so much for coming on.
Pleasure as always, Michael. Hopefully it was helpful. And anyone needs help whatsoever, just reach out. I'd be more than happy to point you in the right direction.
Great. Thanks, Aaron, very much. Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for Kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.